the record in the sense that I don't want to be accused of calling Lester a liar. I'm not interested in that. But I do think that Lester, I mean, I've heard Lester say things that I know for myself, from my own experience, from himself. And I know that Don Kirshner has tried to take credit for creating the Monkees, and that isn't so.
Because I never met Don Kirshner until the record situation was well underway. Where's your microphone on this thing, silly guy?
It's right here.
That's it, huh?
It's
all right.
Stereophonic. I like this story.
Thank you.
Stereophonic.
Right. I already talked to Bert and Bob, so I know who.
Take care of. You took to Bert and Bob, eh?
Yeah.
Did you spend any time with Bert?
About a couple hours.
Yeah. Bert's my hero in this whole operation. He's the one of the whole operation that I think A, had his head on straight, B, had a half a heart. And actually, Bert has more than that, but I mean, had at least a half a heart. And C, both of the above, I don't know. You know, he's the only one. I think he is the artist in the crew, although he doesn't think of himself as an artist.
No, he thinks of himself as more of the business.
He sees himself as a producer and a business person. But I've seen him do really artistic things. I think he's far more an artist than Ravel's. He thinks he is an artist. And basically, I think Bert's the artist. And Bob is like a functionary, only he's a functionary as a director. You know, it's interesting. We usually think of this, the band is the artist and the producer is a functionary. You know?
Right.
Or the actors are the artist and so is the director, but the producer is just a businessman. But it's like when we were recording, when the Monkees were recording, Mickey played the drums, but Mike kept time. In that one record that we all made together, Headquarters, Mike was the timekeeper. Mickey relied, I don't know that Mickey relied on him, but Mike had a much stronger sense of time. And Davey, too. Davey was had a much stronger sense of time. Mickey played the drums like they were a musical instrument, as a color.
Right.
He played the drum color.
He played
four square time, he played the drums, but as a band, there was a drummer and there was a timekeeper and they were different people.
Right.
Unlike, you know, because I'm not sure that's unusual, but
I guess he hadn't drummed professionally before, had he?
No, he hadn't drummed period before.
But I also open up and ask about, you know, how you feel to be back on the road again and how long have you been since the last time you were on the road?
I've been on the road off and on for 4 or 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Doing one version of this or another. The last version was called The New Monks, and we went to Japan and came back broke, for which I have to thank the previous manager, who shall remain nameless.
During that Japanese revival period where like the salt and the broke.
Yeah. Before that, it was the Monkees show starring Peter Tork, and that was two or three different bands and two or three different managers. And, no brownies for this guy. They're not shooting disc camera here.
Music's interesting to you right now.
I like Men at Work. I like Police very much. Both of those guys. I like Joan Jett for her attitude. I like that. You know, she's really angry. She's real angry. And I don't know, you know, it's kind of funny. In some ways, I'm in the same situation. Maybe that's it. Maybe I'm just letting her be angry on my behalf, you know. You know what I mean? She was the front person for the Runaways.
Uh-huh.
And they were regarded as a trick. And here comes Joan Jett, and afterwards she's knocking around for, you know, how long has it been since the Runaways? 10, 15 years? Well, no, it's been, no, 8 years, something like that. Seven or 8 years. And everybody's going, well, you can't, Joan, you're a sweet girl, but you can't be a rock and roller because you were front for the Runaways, see? That means, and everybody goes, that means you're not a rock and roller. And she's going, just a fucking minute! You know? I am, look! Oh, yeah, sure, Joan. Yeah, well, that's a nice record, Joan, but really, you were in the Runaways, see? You don't understand. understand. You were in the Runaways. No, no, Joan, you don't understand. You were in the Runaways. See, that deprives you of your franchise forevermore. And I'm standing there looking at it, and I say, you know, and it's funny because this is just, you know, just as we're talking here, I'm realizing that I have a lot of identification with that position. So, Joan, if you're listening, hi, sweetie, you know, knock 'em dead, more power to you, and, you know, and I never saw the Runaways, and I had no idea whether you'd make it or not. So I'm not one of those sycophants, because I'm probably not a friend at all, but I can identify.
But do you still feel that the monkeys and albatross are a little too early to get into?
No, I don't. Not nearly. The whole idea about the monkeys is that I learned a lot from and through the monkeys, and I wouldn't have traded it for the world in terms of life and experience and so on. But if I had not been a member of the monkeys, my feeling is that I would have in short order, become a popular performer in my own right, because that's what I do, and I would have just kept right on doing it. You know, and if you go see the show now, the people who see the show go, oh, I get it, rock and roll. Oh, excuse me, Peter, I have no idea. And they come to see the Monkees music, and we do Monkees tunes for them. And they come to hear the Monkees songs, and I don't care, and I don't suppose Joan Jett plays any Runaways tunes. But, you know, so to that extent, we're different. But they come to hear the Monkees tunes, and they stick around. An awful lot of people come back afterwards, and they say, you know, I came here to hear the Monkees songs, and I really wasn't expecting much, but thanks a lot, that that was real rock and roll. And that was a pleasant surprise. Can we have a look?
Sure.
That's okay. That's your format. That's why it's black everywhere else.
Yeah, that's the exact format that you see right there. It's 2 foot square.
Wish I'd known you guys were coming with a camera before I knew. I guess you guys called late on purpose just so you wouldn't
hard track. All right. So the band now is playing rock and roll pretty much.
Yes, that's all we play. Rock and roll. Let's see. Let's get rid of some of this clutter. I'll stand away from this little obscure speaker over there. And I think I like the little white and the brick operating together, but we try to. Well, I don't suppose there's going to be any.
Give me a quick update from 68 to 83. We'll knock everything down. What happened after 68? I assume that's when you took through. 83, what kind of perils did you meet?
Perils. There we go. All by itself it goes. In fact, if you glare at it too heavily, it goes off by itself, right?
Right.
You're going to be able to discern when I'm talking about the photograph and when I'm talking to the set of people. Okay, the perils. Pish-tosh. What I was doing was... first thing was that I had a group of my own featuring a couple of women friends and another guy. That folded in my marriage. Well, it was not a marriage then, but the relationship broke up disastrously. So stupidly on my part. Never mind. I went to Marin County to live for a couple of years, and I worked, I was a member of the Sleeping Lady Cafe Cooperative. You probably even have been there.
Yeah.
Go there.
Okay.
Since you live in the neighborhood, it's only about 40 minutes out, half an hour out of town. It's a wonderful little place, and it's still run by the co-op, which means that the waiters and waitresses and barkeeps there all own that place. They're in the co-op. And I was, you've heard of it, of course.
Yeah.
That's your name. And I belong to the Fairfax Street Choir, of which you may also have heard. That didn't last terribly long. It was kind of an Aquarian Age gospel group. 35 voices in a rock section at the time. It was a wonderful, joyful, loving operation. And it's a little better, isn't it?
Talking about the photo.
I have to make it a point to sit up straight. I'm glad for Polaroids. Boy, they really saved the day. Okay, hold on. And I worked in a group called Osceola, which was like a perennial second bill band. Went back to Southern California, and I worked in an acoustic trio, and got into my third, what was to become my third marriage. Hi, Carol.
Hi, dear.
How'd you do?
Got off.
Thank you. Bless you. I bet you invoked my name, eh?
Huh?
Did you invoke my name?
Yep.
They told me it would be good for me.
That was the best story I've heard in a long time.
We just got off of a parking ticket, $40 parking ticket. Carol got it. Our Carol Gore, our manager, was sitting in a van.
I didn't have to use your name, though. He just asked me incidentally, by the way, what show was going after.
Oh, I see. And this cop busted her and stopped her for not having commercial plates in the commercial loading zone when she was not supposed to be there. The cop said she wasn't supposed to be there. Carol was, we were just standing, waiting for the band to come out of this place. Southern California. And I started teaching school. I taught English and social studies and wound up even a baseball coach.
How did your pupils treat you of having been?
Well, they didn't let it show, pretty much. They pretty much had to. You know, the thing is, once a kid gets into a school, he plays by school rules. They're not going to go, oh my God, oh God, you know, day in and day out. You can't do that day in and day out. You know, the guy's there every day. He walks in every day with his books under his arm, sits down and says, okay, hand me your papers, and here's your critiques in the last papers, and here are your tests, and here are your assignments, and we're going to talk about this. And, you know, and they got to write the things down. It's a school just like any other. And after a while, you know, and the old man loses his temper, and I'm the teacher now, you know. And I'm a former pop star to these kids. And they all want to know, and in each class that I taught, we took 20 minutes out of one class each term, and we talked about it, and they asked me questions, and I told them the answers, and then we went back to the business. And they still had their grades to deal with, you know, in their lives, the school life. So it didn't intrude too much. Anyway, I taught school for 3 years in two schools. In the second school that I taught at, I ran across a lot of the same personalities that sort of been glad to get out of show business because of. Period. Ending the sentence with a preposition. And at that point, somebody made me an offer to go on the road doing a Monkees show, an oldies show. And I took the chance because I thought, what the hell, I might as well be back in showbiz. The guy made me an offer that was actually pretty substantial. He couldn't come through on his end of it, but by that time I was out on the road, and I had a band, and we traded management, and then that band and our manager and I changed bands, and then that band and I changed management, and then I had a whole new band, a whole new management, and then I did it one more time, and that brings us to the present situation. The Peter Tork project has gotten to a nice place. But that doesn't cover the perils. The perils. Well, it's hard to say. I have lived through a mortal peril. And I can't say that the peril had everything to do with, or anything to do with showbiz, because other people have been in and out of the same trial. One guy I know has been a doorman
his life. And he had been in and out of the same problem as I have. Another guy has been a janitor all his life. He's been in and out of it. Bus drivers, and this is one of your diseases, and it is called, are you ready? Alcoholism. And it's a mortal disease. And every alcoholic sooner or later quits drinking. So far I've managed to enjoy my life without drink for the last 2.5 years, drinking drugs included. And but being an entertainer is, in my case, was deeply involved with it. One of the features of alcoholism has to do with isolation. You feel that you're better than everybody else. You feel that you're not worthy of anybody else's company. It's called arrogant doormat syndrome. And I had it. What was that sweeping the camera shot routine?
Full motion.
For me, like I said, isolation is one of the names of the disease. And in fact, there's a lot of diseases of isolation that aren't alcoholism. Compulsive gambling, compulsive overeating, compulsive shopping. Some people compulsively shop. They can't keep themselves from spending money in the same way that an alcoholic can't keep himself from drinking. And it's the same disease, the disease of isolation.
Do you think the scene, the rock scene then, in the late 60s or even in the 70s, was really self-destructive?
Well, let me say there's an awful lot of abnormal pressures. I really, I truly believe for myself, for me, that that some of the characteristics of my of the disease were, I had them as a child. Some of them were exacerbated by showbiz. On the other hand, I might not have gotten into showbiz if I hadn't been this way, so they fed each other. Isolated people tend to try to compensate with compensatory techniques involve hours and hours and hours and hours and hours on the guitar, or hours and hours dancing in front of a mirror and pretending to be in showbiz, which winds up being practice for showbiz. Isolation tends to make showbiz people and vice versa. I mean, it's not a hard and fast connection because there's not a lot of people isolate that aren't in showbiz and have no, or any artistic endeavor. Like I said, you know, there are janitors and bus drivers that...
What's your come down after that? I mean, you've been thrust into this immense celebrity and bombed there real quick.
Was there a come down? No, there was relief. Are you also shooting there too, Richard? How's that? It was relief. I was glad to be out of it. I should say yes, but the come down took a year, so I didn't notice it. That kind of thing. The most important the thing is that some of the features of the disease of alcoholism were already at work on me at that point. And while I was not drinking terribly heavily by an awful lot of people's standards, I was already on the road. And like I said, I may have been on the road as a child. There's no way of knowing these things. The bottom came for me in, June of 83. And I managed to quit drinking at that point, and I managed to put down the other drugs in January of, did I say 83? 80.
Okay.
This is 83. 83 years ago. And the following January, 81, I had my last toke of grass, and my last tube of snow, and so.
What's
then, I mean, and the first, and I tried to keep going with this thing, and I did to a certain extent. Like I said, I went into Japan, and from some levels, from some points of view, my career has been puttering along at a pretty steady rate, even through, like I was, I hit my bottom, and I had, Interestingly enough, when I hit my bottom, when I actually did finish drinking, I had no manager and no band. And shortly after that, I met the next to the most recent manager and got started with a band that included some really fine musicians. I was real pleased with the quality. The trouble with the band was that it was too disparate and not desperate.
Gotcha.
Southern drummer with a drawl. I never knew you could drum with a drawl, but he did. A surfer, punk bass player, a jazz rock guitar, fusion guitar and trumpet player, an old line blues guitar player, and me. And I'm a Yankee eclectic.
You're from our hometown.
What?
You're from our hometown.
Which is what?
Washington.
Oh, well, I was born there. I was born in D.C.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But I didn't live there very long. It was a year and a half. We moved out. Lived in Detroit, Berlin, Germany, Badger, and Madison, Wisconsin. Badger no longer exists, I think. Then my family moved to Connecticut, where they live now. I have a brother and sister were born there. One of my brothers was born in Detroit, and the other brother and sister were born in Connecticut.
Can we talk about specifics?
Oh, sure.
I haven't heard a single word about the project since I've been here. But just when you just about came in, being a month here, you talked about the project.
We're going to go full circle.
This guy's, he's talked to, have you gotten the whole, he's talked to Bert Schneider and Bob Rakels and Lester Sill. And
Bobby Hart.
Bobby Hart.
And Jim Frawley.
I'm the first monkey you've talked to, ex-monkey.
Yes. Michael's in trouble.
Michael might not talk to you. And you have to go to Mickey and David to get England. You have to go to England to get Mickey and David.
I know. I'm not complaining. We'll get to the project.
Okay. So. What was the next question?
All right, I just want to ask you what you remember just about the auditions and what we were expecting. And I know Rapelson was a little on the avant-garde side with the interviews. What do you remember about those?
Well, I remember. I'm not going to talk about them in their entirety.
No, just generally, did you know exactly what the concept of the monkeys was going to entail?
Yeah. And did I know how big a success it was going to be? And the answer to that is yes, too, because they told me that, you know, but the idea of it was, the concept was that if it, you know, records, a TV show, concert performances, all of that, you know, and the goal was essentially what you saw. What happened was the goal. Nobody was taken by surprise. I wasn't taken by surprise by the magnitude of the project.
Mm-hmm.
I was, you know, if it went at all, it was going to go that big. Now, as it turns out, there was a problem figuring out whether it was going to go at all, but it wound up going.
How about, you know, later it seems like the band started to reject the whole commercial aspect. Did you know from the start that you were going to run into that trouble, or were you just...
I had projected that I was going to be a musician in the band, and when they started cranking out the records without me, I was disappointed. But I see now, as I look back, that was critical, that's the way it had to be. A lot of things that bothered the bejesus out of me when I was in the group and shortly after I left it don't trouble me in the slightest anymore. The business about the commercial, I was mortified that the records were being made without me. I was humiliated and felt shunned and slighted, the worst thing was that nobody seemed to notice, you know, and I would scream and yell and rave, and they'd scratch their heads and they'd look at me and they'd go, what is this? And I would tell them, and they would say, no, you don't understand. You have no reason. It's the same thing as like this Joan Jett thing. Absolute incomprehension. You know, the person himself does not understand his own experience, which is typical of a lot of what goes on today. The basic person's experience doesn't count. Why are you going through this, Peter? You know, because I felt lied to and I felt humiliated. But you don't have any call to feel that way. Therefore, you know, your human feelings don't count. So, but like I said, if I look back on it now, I see that by the terms of the project, in the project's own terms, that was the way it had to be.
Did that cause a rift? I know that Michael and you kind of sided on one side, and it seemed like there was tension maybe with Mickey and Davey. They're coming from a more theatrical background where possibly, you know, they were used to going on stage with the lines and going to the regular
line. It didn't cause a rift in the sense that when the time came, Bert asked all of us if we wanted to make our record, and we all four said yes. And that's why Bert went ahead and made the changes in the plans and why he suffered the business. You know, I mean, another guy would have, this is what I like Bert for, another guy would have said, I can't let you do it, boys. Kirshner would sue us and we, you know, would take us to court. But Bert doesn't mind a fight, particularly a lot. He won't be threatened, he won't be bludgeoned. And if he wants to do it, he will go ahead and do it. And he wanted us to want to do this. This is what I love Bert for. And he wanted us to want to do it. And while he wouldn't goad us, he certainly didn't deny us the effort. When we wanted to do it, he went ahead and arranged that it be done. And it just absolutely blew Kirshner out of the water.
Right.
Kirshner thereupon left the Monkees and took up a project that was somewhat less threatening. The Monkees being not plastic enough for Don Kirshner, he subsequently went straight to the Archies, who were not going to give him any S-dash-dash-dash, as you will print, if you print this at all.
Now, you look back on it and you say, you know, the commercial aspects don't bother you as much. When looking back on Kirshner, how do you feel about him? And
Kirshner was Kirshner. I have nothing to say for or against him. He definitely had his time, and for a time he was probably the best moneymaker. He probably was. He probably holds the record for as being the best moneymaker over the longest period for a long, long time in terms of just being able to say, that'll sell, that won't, that'll sell, that won't. The only, what Donnie didn't know was that if he could have gone right on being the same guy he was, doing the same things he did, having the same guys be our producer, all we wanted to do was be the musicians in the chairs. And if he had been willing to put up with us being the musicians in the chairs, he could have gone right on being the Monkees' musical overseer, you know, forever and ever. But for some reason, and I don't to this date know why exactly, but for some reason he saw that, you know, obviously it was a challenge because once he says no and we say yes, then it's a challenge. But before that point, why he had to say no and insist that it be a challenge is something I don't understand, because Donnie could have gone right on being the Monkees guy forever, you know, as long as there was a Monkees project. But for some reason, the fact that we wanted to be in the chairs was so threatening to him that he absolutely refused to allow it to happen. It was going to be, you know, over his dead body. And while it didn't quite come to that, it certainly did wind up in his dissociating from the Columbia Screen Gems project.
Was there a scene or something where Nesmith put his fist through the wall?
Yes, there was. Yes, there was. But I don't remember too much about that scene.
Maybe I'll ask him about that. You were cast as the Ringo types, kind of happy-go-lucky, Harpo Marx, slightly naive, shall I say, role. How did you feel about that?
It's the role I brought them. They didn't start me off and say, okay, now do this, now do that, and give us one of these. That's the guy I brought to the show. That's why I was hired. To say about it. That's like coming in as a dancer and then saying, I don't want to dance, but that's why we hired you. I know, but I'm really an artist. You know, no. That's the guy I brought to them. That's the character I brought in.
I think I'm right when I say you had never at least acted in front of TV cameras before.
No, that's right. But I had acted. I was college, high school, amateur, and shows of one kind or another ever since I can remember. I've always, as far as I, there are, my parents tell me about things I did in a showy kind of way since before I can remember. So showbiz, you know, I've always, and my mother is a frustrated performer. She was an actress in the local theater.
What were you concerned about maybe at first going in front of the cameras.
Well, I was nervous, yeah, if that's your question.
No.
But I'm not nervous in front of cameras anymore.
I guess not. Were you assigned to the bass? How did that happen?
Yes, Michael refused to play it, and I could, since I could play all of the things, and Mickey was assigned the role of drummer, that left me with the bass. Yeah, Michael just didn't, he wanted to be the guitar player, and I didn't care.
In the first recordings, before the Headquarters albums, how much of a role did you play?
On the records?
Yeah.
Virtually none.
Vocals here and there?
Occasional background vocals, fourth chair guitar on a couple of Michael's cuts.
Let's go back here. How about the pace of the whole time between the show, recording, and touring?
Pretty hectic.
Did that take its toll at all?
No, I can't relate to that question.
Right.
Sorry.
How much image muzzling was there? I know I read a New York Times Sunday Magazine article back from '60.
They didn't want me criticizing the war right at the onset. I can't think why.
I just remember reading about how you kind of went off a bit about ESP, a couple of things.
ESP?
ESP. And some fairly esoteric things.
What about it?
Figuring that the monkeys were a manufactured image.
No philosophies.
How did they react to that?
Hey, we are the monkeys. We said it all before. The money's in. We're made of tin. We're here to give you more. You see, Head?
Yeah.
What about it?
Yeah, did they try to muzzle you? And
I told you, they wouldn't let me, you know, criticize the war in Vietnam. You don't criticize the president, they said.
But he's wrong.
How far did you push it? Was there anything in the show?
Didn't push it. I'm not a very activist kind of guy. I'm not. My opinions are very strong, but I don't march and I don't play politics, you know.
Nicholson told me that off stage they built a room for you, and according to him, it was the low dope, as he said.
To what?
Low dope. That's how he...
God, he's such a hipster.
Yeah.
They were blowing dope in the 40s and 50s, Bob, but we smoked grass.
Right.
You may have blown dope, Bob, but we smoked grass.
Yes,
they made it nice. It was wonderful. Great big refrigerated room. We could play, you know, set up a little amp and play guitars and things like that. The sound wouldn't creep back into the sound stage. Air conditioned. We went back there and had our alfalfa sprouts lunches. Typical of that confusion, we had alfalfa sprout lunches and vegetarian pate and vegetarian burgers and smoked grass.
All four of you were brought together. It's logical to think that four people who make it that far could be a little headstrong and possibly they're not going to get along. From the start, how did it go? And did there, after a while, was there a gelling of talents? Did you feel that you were?
Yeah, both ways. There always was some, and there was always some tension. There was always some gelling. We had one, in every group of four, there are six pairs. There were six fights, one each. I have an awful lot of respect for those guys. They are, each one of them in his own right is an enormous and amazing talent. And,
How about Head? How do you look back on that movie, I thought?
I thought it was a corker, to use an old expression. I thought it was... excellent. I think it's an excellent movie. My brother doesn't like it, but tough darts, Nick. It's an excellent movie. And I think it's going to stand more excellent as time goes on, because what's happening as time goes on is that it's becoming a chronicle of an age, as well as... at the time, it was just a chronicle of the monkeys. But it's going to become a chronicle of the age. Ray Wilson took the opportunity to quote from an awful lot of movies, from an awful lot of genres.
Mm-hmm.
And I think...
Did it give you a cathartic release in a way? Having been sort of frustrated with...
Well, no, it was just as much trouble making that movie as it was doing the TV show. For one thing, working for Rapinson is very difficult. It's a very hard man to work for. He was not, to me, an artist's director. I was saved by the fact that Nicholson was on the set. If it hadn't been for him, I know there's one scene for sure that I never would have gotten through except for Nicholson being on the set. And Nicholson, I think, is a master. Nicholson really knows what he's doing. He's serious. And the fact that Nicholson was involved in the project, I think, was the making of it.
You were the first to quit.
Thank you.
Why exactly did you do it at the time? Was it an agreement you had come to?
No, I didn't want to hang out with those guys anymore. I wanted to... They said, Peter, if you want to have your own group, you'll have to go and do it. And what I thought that's what I wanted. When I see now that I could have been perfectly content just being one of the musicians in the band. As it turns out, you know, the fourth album, Pisces Aquarius,
right.
I'm on that album a lot. I'm playing piano on this cut, bass on that cut, guitar on this other cut. You know, I'm all over the place. And that's really all I could have been content with that, feeling the way I do now. But I wasn't in those days. It's just more of what I was saying before, that I was... One of the things about being an incipient alcoholic, if not an actual one, is this notion that you, other people have got to do it your way. I had to be the producer and the director and the stage writer, you know. It had to all be my way. And you can't have that in life. You don't get that in life.
So, musically, what do you look back on as the highlights of the Monkees? I know Pleasant Valley Sunday was a...
Pleasant Valley Sunday, headquarters as a whole. I think that album is a very young band with a lot of enthusiasm and promise, and I think and as such, the album stands up today. It's not a mature rock band by any stretch, you know, but I think there's a lot of... The fact that we were actually working, I think the music shows a lot of inventiveness and energy. Concentration. I think it's a very good album for its time and place. It doesn't stand up. I mean, but I heard Randy Skousket, Mickey's Psycho Jello tune from that album. It sounded pretty good to me the other day. Liked it fine. Did you like it, Carol? You heard it. We played Randy Skousket. We played it on the radio the other day. Sounded pretty good, eh?
I just
dropped the sticks at the end. Mickey dropped the sticks, and that's included. Great.
You sit on the piano and...
Yeah, that's me on the piano. That's me on piano on Pleasant Valley Sunday and Daydream Believer. That's actually my hand. It's great, you know, to hear when... who's the Canadian song coach? Did a Daydream Believer redid
Anne
Murray. They copped my piano lick. That's my piano lick. I invented, you know, a simple little lick, but there was my lick, and they invented it, and they copped it. Great.
I guess it was a Monkees... international fair or something a couple weeks ago. I heard, like, in Hartford, it seems to live on. There's still a lot of Monkees fans.
Chicago, just the other day,
another festival.
Yep, Midwestern Monkees. Did it? All right.
So the fan teams keep going. How do you explain it? I mean, obviously it was good music, good show.
Touch somebody. Somehow. Reached out and touched someone. I don't know. You know, you should do an ad for Bell. I don't know. I have no idea. I have no idea why. I think we stand for...
You're stuck in line. You're starting to catch up.
And the Peter Crawl. Right. From Canada. Where did... Brian Howell, Morrisburg, Ontario. I'm going to have to check that out. It's a Scotty brand envelope, too. That's nice. The reason that the Monkees meant so much to so many people, I think, is because without threatening them, there seemed to be an element of this is the way things could be. It's a phony in that part of the implication is this is the way it could be except for real life. But at the same time, there is this offer that people can get together and, you know, it was part of the 60s, all you need is love kind of notion. And I think that, I mean, every era, you know, some people are still stuck in the 30s. You know?
Right.
And there's going to be people stuck in the 60s for the rest of their lives.
Bert put it pretty well. I thought he said that instead of father knows best, it was the kids knows best.
The kids know best?
Kids know best.
Great. That's not bad. That's real good. Thank you, Bert.
Did you feel any, while you were doing it, a certain feeling of anti-establishment?
Certain, but what the hell, I mean, no. I mean, we allowed ourselves some of that feeling, but
And in some ways, again, this is Bert's genius, you know, is that he trod the dividing line. He trod the edge. And he was, you know, you have to play establishment games to get a show on television. He knew how to play establishment games. Did you hear Bert's acceptance speech when he won the Oscar?
No.
You know Bert won an Oscar?
It was for Last Picture Show, or?
Hearts and Minds.
Hearts and Minds.
By, what's his name, Peter Draves? I don't know, Peter something, I can't remember his last name. A guy named Peter something produced, and Bert put out the money for it, and therefore when it won, and not when the movie won an Oscar, he won the Oscar for a movie called Hearts and Minds. And when he accepted his Oscar, he celebrated the victory of the People's Army over the imperialist warlords and their running lackeys in Vietnam. This is just after Vietnam was over. And so, you know, there's a guy who's not interested in playing in just, you know, but who's just interested in playing with the establishment. He doesn't want to get rich on and by playing their games. On the other hand, he also wants to be part of the street. And there's problems with every position, but I think Bert walks the line very nicely, at least he did in those days, and I hope he's still struggling along the same lines myself.
Yeah, it seems like this. The group was undeniably based a bit on Beatles. When Monkey Mania set in, just what was like that like? Playing England, I heard, was crazier than when the Beatles had played there.
I wouldn't know about that. I'm beginning to feel that we're harping on these questions. I mean, I know that you spent a long time asking these questions, but I don't know whether it was bigger or better than the Beatles. I'm no authority on that.
No, I just meant the fan adulation.
What about it? I found it very constricting. Like, if I can't walk on the streets in London, what's the point of being there? I appreciated it, you know, but what are you going to do? John Lennon said that to the end of his days, he could not walk in London. Yes, he could. He often did.
You were talking about Monkey's Convention. Can I read you something?
Yeah. Wanna?
I just got home from the Monkey's Convention in Connecticut, and I heard some really great things about the Peter Cork Project. I've heard of them before, of course, but I hadn't talked to anyone who'd seen them. Well, I talked to Maggie McManus, and she raved on. What I would like to know is if you can send me a list of the project's upcoming dates. If they ever get close enough to home, I would just love to go see them. Peter's music has always been great, but it sounds like he's really got something special to sign with his band. I can't wait till they release an album. I hope it will be soon. Give Peter my love and best wishes to the band.
We did do, yeah, well, good for them. Good for them all. I hope every single one of them becomes a project fan, too.
Well, the project's happening, and Monkey's
on.
You've got
to convert
them.
Really?
Well, I've taken the hint here. Oh, why don't we talk about the project a bit?
What a good idea.
Yes, it was.
You know, I don't want to dwell on it too long, because I want
to... I thought it might be interesting for you to realize that, you know, this is something that these people that aren't Monkey fans are taking as bona fide projects and acting upon it, actually supporting. They're making project buttons, they're gigs, they're doing...
Should I wear a t-shirt for the...
Yes!
Hang on, t-shirt.